Digging Deeper with At The Coalface, the podcast that shares the incredible stories
of the talented and passionate people in our industry.
This episode of Digging Deeper with At The Coalface, brought to you with the support of New South Wales Mining. Responsibly mining coal for today and tomorrow, with experts restoring land after mining at every single mine. And your host, Jessica Rouse.
Welcome to another episode of Digging Deeper with At The Coalface. A very special episode today. We're in Scone in the Upper Hunter for the first of a couple of episodes celebrating 50 years of the Westpac Rescue Helicopter Service in northern New South Wales. Today, we're catching up with one of the most well-known faces of the service, Head of Community Engagement Richard Jones, also the former CEO of 27 years, and Noel, who was rescued from a mine site by the helicopter. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Jess, absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Now, Richard, I want to start with you because this year is a huge year of celebration for the rescue service that has saved so many lives over the years.
Yeah, 50 years, who would have thought? I mean, I've only been there for just on 30 now, so more than half my working career, of course. But it's just been such a pleasure to see the growth of this. But you know what? It wouldn't have been possible without our wonderful communities. And in particular, we're here in the Upper Hunter, so let's face it, the mining community has been at the forefront. And in fact, a former colleague who's sadly passed away, Bob Purser, did a lot of our comms in the early days, yeah, before anyone could spell comms and knew what it was about. But Bob always reminded me that it was indeed the mining community that really kicked this service along, because of course mining started around the Lake Macquarie, and as it moved further up the Hunter Valley, the miners travelling to and from work on the roads, they're getting further away from critical health care. So that's when helicopters, the standard of them, the speed of them, the safety of them became more critical, and then the miners just kept digging deeper in their pockets. So to the MEU, the guys and girls that, you know, they have a member on our board, which is more than appropriate. And then there's the coal miners, you know, the day-to-day coal miners. And now they're travelling a lot longer. And you go up to the Gunnedah Basin and beyond, down to Mudgee. You know, this is a vast network of coal mining communities here in the west part of the state, and of course here in the Upper Hunter and in the Gunnedah Shire.
Yeah, and you touched on an important point there. I think, speaking of the Gunnedah Basin, I've spoken to a couple of guys up there who've been rescued by the chopper. They haven't had accidents on site. They've had them travelling to and from site, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of them. We say that mining is probably less than 0.5% of our workload, thank God, because of the safety. Noel was in that was just a terrible, terrible accident. And of course, I won't say decline in healthcare in the bush, but maybe just the amount of, say, everyone from paramedics to clinics to hospitals, everything gets centralised now as well. And that's why the helicopters needed to be upgraded. So the New South Wales government, through health and New South Wales ambulance, committed funding to get bigger, faster, safer helicopters. So I think a fact I learnt at our conference in the States about 6 years ago was that more than 95% of the population of New South Wales live within 1 hour flight time of a major trauma centre. And that's pretty good. That's pretty world class. That's very impressive.
Exactly. And you mentioned you've been with the service for 30 odd years now. Obviously, you've seen a lot of changes, the expansion of the service, particularly to cater for that growing need.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's blown me out of the park is I'm not an aviator. I'm very much a community person, but to see the advice of some of our critical people over the years, like Peter Cook, our former chief pilot, Graham Nickerson, the crew chief who was on Noel's incident, and the pilot, Ian Osborne, who sends his regards to Noel. He's a wonderful man. I still live very close to Ian. The advancement in technology. Peter Cook took on a mission for night vision goggle technology 20 years ago, and he fought for 10 years until it was implemented at the service. And it wasn't a lack of effort from our board, or wasn't the money. It was actually night vision goggles, military specification type equipment. So it was nearly approval from the US State Department to get these things, and they have to be in a locked safe, which they still do. But we just wanted to use them for good, not for, you know, flying around and crashing up villages
exactly
in Afghanistan or something like that. So that sort of technology thing is, it transpires. You think about it, it's really, really simple, you know. Mm-hmm. Bigger, faster, safer helicopters to support our wonderful people in regional or the New South Wales.
I feel like there would be a lot of those sorts of things behind the scenes that we, you know, you don't hear about the night vision goggles for one and the fight to get those in use with the service. There'd be so many things.
Well, the in-house capability of our engineering team has just... Like when I started, we had 20 full-time staff. We had a budget of about $3.5 million. And as I sit here today, we've got nearly 170 full-time staff. We have just on 40 engineers to maintain these machines and keep them in the air 24/7. And then at Broadmeadow, our headquarters is our heavy maintenance facilities. It is world-class stuff, this is. And it wouldn't be possible without A, New South Wales government, ambulance, the health system, and our coal mining communities right from the start till we sit here now. You know, they've been involved for every one of those 50 years.
Yeah.
It's been quite remarkable.
Yeah, definitely. And over the years, you would have seen, you know, a lot of missions undertaken by the helicopter in those mining places in regional New South Wales. Are there any missions that sort of stand out to you?
Well, obviously, Knowles is very significant. And we're just talking off air about the wonderful story. The stuff we were able to do when we had a second machine was when I might let Noel tell that story later about taking him back to the mine site. It was really, and that was just before I started. But I've known Noel for all of my career because he's always reached out to help. And I don't think we played golf against each other, but he would have whipped me.
I was going to say, he surely would whip you.
Because I'm really no good. I'm terrible, but it's a great pastime. But it's just so many changes, and probably the technology and the scope and capability of the aircraft is one. But one thing that hasn't changed is the commitment of our communities.
Yeah. And the wonderful thing of people who have been rescued by the service wanting to come on board and say, okay, you've saved my life. What can I do to help someone else or help the service?
Yeah, it's really, we started these, what we call rescue clubs. So we have a couple of times a year where, and obviously we're not allowed to know patients' details and names. And so we rely on them to come back to us. With the vast number of missions we have done, it's a very small percentage of people that do come back. And I guess there's a couple of reasons for that. One is they probably don't want to remember the trauma, which is completely understandable. And then there's other people that can't do enough for you, and they volunteer or they help raise money at golf days. And and remember the golf days we used to have at Musselbrook. You know, there was 200 people. Now it took 8 hours on the golf course, but a lot of coal miners in those days could have a day off work, and they didn't care if it took 10 hours.
Yeah.
But it was all there for one purpose. And great Joe and Margaret Matthews, we'll remember those guys, were, you know, wonderful supporters, part of the mining industry, and just wanted to give a little bit back. So it's been a magical 30 years for me so far, and hopefully I've got another 5 or 10 in me.
20.
So, Noel, take us back to your chopper story. What happened? What was going on that day?
Well, the day I had the accident, I was working above ground doing it. We were revamping the washery to get it ready to go in. It'd been closed down for a while and we're getting it ready. And just on lunchtime, I was doing an overtime shift. And at lunch, at half past two, at 2 o'clock, I got the information that they wanted me down underground. The machine had broke down, but it was only 7 cut-throughs from the face. That's not a long distance.
Yeah.
And I went over and got my cap and goggles and everything else that I could do, brought my tools down. But we had to go down in another machine down, and the driver took me down. And normally speaking, when that happens between shifts, that nobody else should have ever come down the pitch, you know. No other machine should have come down. It should have been stopped there and then. But that didn't happen. Anyway, I was down underground, and air over hydraulics. That's what keeps the machine going. And we tried to start it. I tried to start it. Well, the driver in it, David Bradshaw, he tried to. I disconnected the injector and pumped it up, and he gave it a go, and no sound, don't know. So we right away were thinking, but the noise from that, another machine came down the pit, an IMCO, and the chap that was driving the IMCO, instead of having that bucket behind him, he had it in front of him, and he didn't see us. And his IMCO hit the machine, the man transport machine that we went down in, and it came across from the side of the... there's not a great lot of room on underground in the roads. They're not roads for two or three machines passing one another. You don't pass anyone. You only got enough room for one machine to come down and one to go out. And if you have to go, if another machine is coming up, he has to go into one of the cut-throughs. But this machine, he hit the machine that took us down. And I don't know what happened, but the way the wheels must be torn away from the rib, and it came straight over and hit me. That was it. And next, I'm on the ground, I don't know. And next, a first aid man turned up, Shorty Madrill turned up, and I said, "Oh, God." I didn't know. I thought it was Stan Taggart, and he said, "No, it's Shorty." I said, "Oh, that'd be like nice, Shortly. Here I am just about to meet me mate, and you're the last person I can say goodbye to, you know?" Well, I didn't say it to him like that. I put a few swear words in it.
I can imagine.
And then... he said, "You'll be right." So he got on the phone, and the phone rang the helicopter. He rang pit top, rang the helicopter. And fortunate for me, very fortunate for me, the helicopter wasn't out on another job, because you only had the one helicopter there, you know?
Yeah.
And if the helicopter had been out on another job, I wouldn't have been here to talk to you now. But the helicopter did fly up, and when it did land, it landed at the pit, and then it went back up in the air again. The paramedics, and I think there was a doctor on it as well, I'm not sure, I couldn't tell you how many people came down, but first I can remember was the paramedic saying, "Did you take his clothes off?" He said, "I've got someone." He said, "Well, get them all off." And they put me into a bag, you know. I don't know much about that. But in the meantime, the helicopter had left the pit and gone back to Singleton Hospital, picked up blood and came back up to the pit again, so as they had blood for me when I got out into the helicopter. Yeah. And, well, it seems to take forever, but the last person I remember was Godfrey Adam Twaite, one of the undermanagers. He was standing outside the helicopter. He said, "No, I'm sorry." I said, "Don't worry, Godfrey, I'll be back, you know. Nobody else thought I'd be back, but I did." And so that was that part of it, you know. And then I remember flying to the John Hunter in the helicopter, and I'm begging for a drink, you know, and they couldn't give you a drink in my condition, you know. They just wet my lips with water. And then I remember landing at the John Hunter, and that was the end of it for a week.
Yeah.
And then when I woke up, I was a leg minus.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you know the extent of your injury?
No, I didn't know the extent of my injury. When I woke up, the nurse said to me, they were sitting beside me, I was in intensive care, and she said, "What would you like?" I said, "A cup of tea would be nice, you know." And that was sort of it, you know. And like I spent it, and the doctors... that night, I was speaking to our great doctors, and I spoke to them all afterwards, and they said, "We worked on you, Noel, but we didn't think we'd have you the next day, you know." We were convinced, because there was more blood given to me than soldiers even got in Vietnam, you know. I was 87 units of blood given to me, unreal. Untold before. Never happened before, but that was it. And while I was in the hospital, I was there for, actually, the head doctor was Dr. Bissett. He was the head doctor, and he was my doctor, and I was lucky in that respect to have him. And Peter Mitchell was the orthopaedic surgeon who took my leg away from the hip, and Martin White was the other doctor that had all the works with me inside, and they were very, 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 very brilliant doctors and brilliant people. And I have met Peter Mitchell once in the last 10 years. I think I've seen him once, and he's still still as good as gold, but he's a great orthopedic surgeon. You'd have to give him great credit. But they all told me I was a very lucky man. And they were going to move me, Dr. Bissett was going to move me over to the John Hunter, where I did originally go. When you lose a limb, you go into the John Hunter. But when he first wanted to move me in, the nurses said I wasn't ready to go. And such a nice doctor, he came down and said, "No, I'm the head of here, but I'll tell you, you'll go to the John Hunter when the nurses say you're ready." So that's the kind of doctor he was.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a doctor that stood at the door and waved to you. He was a doctor that came in and sat down on the side of the bed and say, and have a bit of a yarn and a talk and all. And he had a young lady that was a lady training doctor over from Japan. And she was the nicest girl I think I've ever met in my life. She was a wonderful person. And she used to come down at night and sit beside me on the bed and talk. And we made friends. We were friends for life, but I don't remember her name. But that's,
she remembers you.
But she went back to Japan, and she's married, has children of her own. But she was a very good doctor. I think she's a baby doctor. I'm not sure. They're a doctor for children, you know.
Yeah. I'm curious, take me back to your time in mining. At that time, you're at Liddell. How long had you been in mining? What was it like?
19 years in
19
mining.
19 years.
Underground mining. Yep. We were underground. Well, I started off in the washery up on top for a year or something like that, and I went underground. I was underground for the next 18 years. Yeah.
I imagine even, certainly in the 80s, safety wouldn't be anywhere near what it is these days.
Well, safety was always fairly alert, you know.
Yeah.
Your fellow workers kept the safety bit too, you know. And you learned quickly that you don't do the wrong thing, you know. Like, we used to do... Well, before the long wall came in, this was, you know, pillar and board and all like that.
Yeah.
And when the deputies say, "Right, fellas, get out," you move the machine and yourself and everything else out. You had to do that right away, because he would know, looking at the props, that when you're in a pillar and boring, the props are, the diameter are not as big as the normal pit props, and they can see them bending like Robin Hood's bow, you know. And he knows by seeing them bending, like, and you might be, that the roof is getting heavy and heavy and heavy. So you get out. But see, the safety, and we had some very good deputies, and the safety was always there. That safety was there.
Yeah. And the camaraderie of underground miners is quite something else.
Oh, it was very, very good. It was great. You know, we had good times, and we always had our Christmas parties, and all the kids would go along, and the money that we'd have put in, so as every kid would get a little Christmas present and all. That was all very, very good. And now it was... Some people, I never worked in the open cut, so I can't speak on the open cut, but some people do tell me they'd rather be in underground than open cut, people that have been in both places.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
Mm.
Did having that camaraderie with your workers underground keep you that little bit calmer when the accident happened? Did it help in a way?
Oh, well.
As awful as the accident was.
We've had a few accidents before that. Yeah. Even before my accident, we had an accident where two miners were killed, you know. And one was just about to retire. And the other chap was a young chap from Cessnock. I think he was about 24, 25 years of age. I'm not sure. And they were killed. The roof fell in just on top of them, you know. And that was so sad. And the older man, he was, I think he was 59 at the time. And in them days, when you hit 60, you retired in the mining. There was no 61 or 62, 60, and then you were out. That was it. You know what I mean? Now today, I think you could work till you were 100 if you were able to keep going. Because I think the government, the taxman, wants you there all the time to get the money. But unfortunately, when I was there, it was 60, and I would have had another 10 years to go till I was 60 when I had the accident, you know.
Yeah.
And I did go back to work. I tell you that now, the helicopter come up and picked me up at my house and we went back to work, but I only lasted about 4 or 5 months. Now, when I went back to work, I didn't go back to do the same job as I was doing before. I was a fitter underground or a fitter above ground, fitter in the washing. But when I went back, they put me in what they call the lamp cabin. And the lamp cabin is where the lamps that you put on your head.
Yep.
And the light that the deputy takes down and all, you do all, fix all them up. And they're what the lamp cabin is. And I was there, I was doing about 3 days a week, three half days a week. I was driving from the Middlebrook Road down to the, and it's 20, about 32 kilometres down and back again, you know. But I just got to the stage I wasn't able for it. And I had to retire just before the Christmas.
Yeah.
I was there, that would have been nearly a year after I had the accident. I went back into work, you know.
Yeah. And you just mentioned the helicopter coming to your house. Tell me about that story. How did that come about?
They decided when I was coming back to work, the helicopter decided they would pick me up and take me back to work. And that was funny. And we did do that. Warren Cook was there. He was one of the Federation workers in the pit, and he lived in Scone, close to me. So he was there with me, and the helicopter landed. Ian Osman was the pilot, and he dropped the helicopter down there, and we got in, and he dropped me back down at work. So I was taken from work by helicopter to John Hunter, and I was taken from home to work by the helicopter. So I think I might be one of the few people in the history if the helicopter taken, delivering and replacing, you know.
That's a great way to put it.
I can confirm, Noel, that you're the only one that that's ever happened for. I think it was a story at the time that just, you know, shook the hell out of the industry.
Yeah.
And Noel being such a committed community member. And,
yeah.
And we just felt, you know, and we had a second machine then, so we could do stuff like that. But that was a very solid day to be able to do that for Noel and his family and his workmates, in fact. So
I'm
sure there was a standing ovation there, Noel.
Yeah, we're very lucky. Actually, I should tell you, I got had the accident on the 26th of March, 1992. And my wife that I have with me now, Valerie, she come out from Ireland later in that year, and we got married in on the 20th of March, 1993. Huh. So am I a lucky man? No one else would have looked after a man with one leg only, Valerie. I sometimes think she's crazy. But
she probably thinks you're crazy.
No.
That's beautiful. And now are you, what do you, after your accident and obviously after recovery and that sort of thing, do you give back to the Westpac chopper?
Oh, anything I can do, I can do for the Westpac. And I got, my son was working in Chelsea soccer team in England, and he sent over a few jerseys from there to have auctioned, and they went very well. And then he was with Manly, and he was North, well, he started off with North Sydney, he wasn't with them then, but when I had the accident, he was in university in Newcastle.
Yeah.
But he has done a fair few times with the different jobs he's had and put stuff in the way of the helicopter.
Yeah.
So, those shirts and things like that, you know, they mightn't cost him much money, but to get them there and get them with the name behind them from the football teams.
Exactly.
Is a very good thing, and people do buy them at auctions.
Yeah.
And we've had a fair few auctions, you know, at the golf club and places like that. Mm.
I feel like you want to say something, Jonesy.
Oh, no, it's just, again, it's just the relationships.
Yeah.
And Noel's son that he talks of, Joe Kelly, is the current CEO of the Sydney Roosters. And
there you go.
And I had lunch with him again through the relationship
that
we built up. And Joe has been a great supporter through Noel, through Dad, and through the family. And that's what I do now as a community part of things. You know, the relationships I'm able to pick up and go and spend some time with them. Because I think one of the successes of the organisation, apart from the people and the people that we've supported is the people that support us, the extended family members and groups and links into the Scone community.
Yeah.
And I've got a younger brother that lives just up the road at Wingen, which we'll talk about later. And And here's a little fact for you. So the 6th of December 1975 was our first mission. Hence our 50 years. So my younger brother Tony was part of a group of reprobates about 8 or 10 years old who were at Merriweather Beach, and they all thought it was fun to scarper up the cliff. And when they got a little bit too high, they all crapped themselves, which is a technical term, and they all scampered down except for one kid. And that was the first mission that the helicopter ever undertook. So it was a static line. It wasn't a winch.
Yep.
So, my brother was part of the first, unwittingly, part of the first mission that the helicopter ever undertook. It's quite remarkable. Yeah. Only worked that out last year. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Your connection to the chopper just got even more.
Oh, yeah. It's bizarre. But, again, just as part of the community. Yeah. You know, the relationships for me are what it's all about. And that's the strength and the base of this organisation is really solid because of our community.
Mm.
Started in Newcastle and the Upper Hunter and the Mudgee area now and Gunnedah Shire and right throughout northern New South Wales. I think we're an integral part, obviously, of the healthcare chain. And I guess that's one thing I do want to say. So, you know, we're the transport mode, but it's those remarkable people in the back of the aircraft, the critical care paramedics and the doctors. And then in Noel's case, the first respondents, Mines Rescue.
Yeah.
You know, they're there on the spot. And then you move out into, imagine being west of Moree. You know, it's the VRA and the SES and the cops and the fireys and then the AMBOs get involved, you know, in time and then might be a couple of hours before the helicopter gets called into action. So all these remarkable volunteers at the mine site, at the scene of an incident in remote, you know, western New South Wales, you know, we've got to take our hat off and we're part of an emergency service chain and every link in that chain's got to be really solid for it to work and that be able to provide assistance to people like my great mate sitting next to me.
Exactly. I think that's a perfect spot to end, gentlemen. Thank you so much for jumping on the podcast today.
I just going to tell you there, really, that two miners that I worked with died after I had my accident in the mine, you know. And one of them was union, and he was a very good tradesman from Brankston. And then there was a deputy that was died there too. He got caught between two doors, you know. It's so sad when you work with people and then they incidentally. But when you take work in a mine, it is a dangerous place. But unfortunately, 99% of the time, we all get home safe and sound. But the rest of us, the other 1%, is the sad part about undermining. Well, as Richard does say there, travelling on the road is a very big thing.
Mm.
And today, now that you have people working 10-hour shifts 5 days a week, and you have to work 10 hours and then you travel home and you have an hour to go to work and an hour to get back again, that's 12 hours. And it's very easy to go asleep.
Exactly.
While you're driving a car. And I think a lot of accidents happen that way.
Mm, definitely. Well, Noel, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. Much appreciated.
No, thank you very much for inviting me and asking me to tell you. But I would like to say to Richard and to the helicopter, thank you very, very much. It has saved so many lives, saved my life and thousands of other people's lives, and it will continue to do that.
Well, that's today's episode of Digging Deeper Without the Coalface. Thanks to New South Wales Mining Responsibly for today and tomorrow. Find out more about the industry's responsible mining practices and meet more great people from the industry on their social media channels. Now, wherever you are listening to this episode, make sure you leave us a rating and a review. We really appreciate it. You can find out more info at our website. And if you've got a story or an idea for an episode, please get in touch, Jess@thecoalface.net.au. We'll see you next time.